Pope Benedict XVI arrives here in Washington, D.C. today for a week-long visit to the United States. It's his first visit to the U.S. as Pope, and there are any number of political, cultural, and spiritual issues surrounding the occasion, but it's also a logistical operation of enormous proportions, months in the planning. If you've been involved in the preparations or if you have questions about how and why and where it's all being staged, and who's paying for it? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can weigh in on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. But we're going to begin with a conversation on a slightly different point. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Michael McGough. He's the senior editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, who recently wrote an op-ed called Papal Dress Code, about what the Pope is going to be wearing and the significance of it. And Michael, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be here.
And why is what the Pope wears important?
Well, I noticed looking at blogs, browsing on the internet, that there was a tremendous amount of commentary about the Pope's vestments. And as a former altar boy from actually pre-Vatican II days, I started to look at these pictures and realized that the Pope, to the great satisfaction of a lot of conservative Catholics, has taken out of mothballs some of the very elaborate vestments that popes used to wear in the 1950s and the 1850s.
Hmm. And these would be the sky-high mitre, that
right.
hat that he wears?
That's right. I remember a movie in the 70s that Joan Rivers and Billy Crystal did where there was a Pope character and they called it the Holy Hat. It's the double-pointed hat. After the Vatican Council in the 1960s, popes and other bishops started to downsize these mitres. They got shorter and shorter, harking back to a style that was actually used in the Middle Ages. And Pope Benedict quite consciously has sort of ratcheted up the mitres. And he now wears some that are just as tall as the mitres worn in the Renaissance or worn in the 19th century. And this is something that is a kind of code for conservative Catholics to show that this is a back to the future pope.
And that the other style, known as the Gothic style, I've learned from reading your piece, that was favored by more recent popes, that was a sign of the reformer, the liberal in the Catholic Church.
That's right. In the 1950s, before the Vatican Council, people who were considered liberals in the Catholic Church expressed that partly by going back to the medieval style of vestments, which in some cases were quite ornamental, but which clearly were not the vestments worn at the height of the papacy in the 18th and 19th century. The current Archbishop of Washington, Archbishop Worrell, wears one of these short mitres. Interesting to see if he and the Pope will clash when they get together. But the Gothic style came to be associated with reforms like saying the Mass in English, having the priest face the congregation instead of facing the altar. So this is kind of, sartorial code language.
And indeed, that it's also seen by some radical traditionalists, as you describe them in the Catholic Church, as a surrender too much of a compromise with Protestants.
Yes. Some Protestants don't wear vestments at all. You can see Protestant televangelists who have quite nice suits, but they're suits you or I could wear. But actually, the Gothic vestments have taken hold in the Lutheran and Episcopal churches. And so, like having the Sunday service in English, wearing a Gothic vestment is something you'll find in a Catholic church, in a Lutheran church, in a Methodist church even, in an Episcopalian church. And by going back to this Roman style, the Pope, I think, is sending a signal that the Catholic Church has a great tradition and it didn't begin in the 1960s, and I'm going to dramatize that by what I wear.
And interesting. One more question to you, and that is, why did the Church adopt these elaborate vestments to begin with? Weren't these originally based on what people pretty much wore around the days of the Roman Empire?
That's absolutely true. And if Christianity had started today, 2,000 years from now, the Pope might be wearing a Brooks Brothers suit. These were ordinary garb of the Roman Empire. As fashion changed, priests and bishops kept wearing what they had been wearing, And in the Middle Ages, some very clever theologians even came up with very exotic spiritual and symbolic explanations. For example, the mitre, which was originally just something to keep the Pope's head warm, has two points on it, and this became symbolic of the two horns of the Old Testament and the New Testament. But this was all after the fact. These originally just began as clothes everybody wore.
Well, Michael McGough, stick around in case anybody wants to call up with a question about papal vestments. So
okay.
He's here with us in Studio 3A. Joining us now from our bureau in New York is Sewell Chan, Metropolitan Reporter for the New York Times and editor of the City Room blog at newyorktimes.com. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And let me ask you, the logistical questions that surround this papal visit, you reported in the newspaper, obviously months in the planning, even before the trip was underway. But as a practical matter, how do you serve communion to 57,000 people in 14 minutes?
Well, in some ways, that question is really probably the most daunting logistical challenge that the Archdiocese of New York faces. In Washington, they're giving out communion to 46,000 people in 20 minutes, and I suppose that comparatively sounds much easier compared to 57,000 in 14 minutes. What they've done is divide up Yankee Stadium into really three or four different sections or tiers, and they've literally looked at all the different priests. There are 530 priests and deacons who will be distributing communion, and they've lined them up by birthday, literally in a big database, and they assigned the youngest priests and deacons, those who are the most able-bodied, really recent seminary graduates, to go to kind of the upper tiers where the stairs between the seats are actually very quite narrow and quite steep. You know, the kinds that you typically see the food vendors racing up and down during games, and older and more senior priests and deacons will actually be at the lower level, the main field level, and also in the bleachers area, which are relatively level and fairly even. And what surprised me in researching this is that the Archdiocese has actually prepared a communion training and safety video, and it's available online, and they're also going to broadcast it on the Jumbotrons at Yankee Stadium several times before the Pope arrives on Sunday, literally walking people through, walking the parishioners through four different scenarios, depending on where they're seated. In some cases, the Pope will come by and stand at the end of your row and actually reach over the seats to hand out the communion wafers. In other places, the priest will be standing in the aisle or on the concourse, and you'll line up as you would in a normal church.
Benedict will not, of course, be the first Pope to say Mass at Yankee Stadium. In fact, there's been a long-running one of my favorite trivia questions to name the former cardinals honored with plaques at Yankee Stadium. Of course, you have to throw Paul VI and John Paul II in there, along with Roger Maris and Miller Huggins. But what's the fascination with ballparks? He's giving a Mass, as you mentioned, at the Washington Nationals Park here in Washington, D.C. as well.
That's right. He has chosen two ballparks. It is a little bit interesting. John Paul II in 1995 did not celebrate Mass at Yankee Stadium that year. He did so in 1979, but in 1995 he chose the Great Lawn at Central Park, the Aqueduct Racetrack in Queens, and also a site at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. He really had three kind of pretty big masses in the New York metropolitan area. I think ballparks are kind of, in some ways, a natural venue because they obviously have so many seats and are used to handling big crowds. One of the things I was told is that in 95 it was a little bit tough to do the Great Lawn in Central Park. A Great Lawn is a nice open space, but there's really no facilities. And so everything from, portable toilets to electricity for the grandstand and for the, for the performances before the Mass and the lighting, all of that had to kind of be brought in. At Yankee Stadium, much of that infrastructure is already in place. And, when you're trying to, tell people to come hours and hours early and you're plying them with food and drink, obviously you have to have enough bathroom facilities for them. And that's a real concern, in an event of nearly 60,000 people to have enough bathroom facilities. Even at St. Patrick's Cathedral, where there is going to be a Mass on Saturday that the Pope is celebrating just for members of the clergy and members of religious orders, they're expecting so many crowds outside on Fifth Avenue in Midtown Manhattan that they're actually lining up a whole, bank of portable toilets on 51st Street right outside St. Patrick's.
And the tickets to these events, as I understand it, are free. Nevertheless, aren't people going to hawk them on eBay?
Well, in both Washington and New York, the tickets are gone. If you don't have one by now, it's much too late. There are, however, two opportunities still, and I'll address the scalping issue. In both Washington and New York, most of the tickets were assigned pretty closely by name and address. Certainly for Yankee Stadium, you had to supply your name, your address, and your date of birth to your local pastor. And that pastor then had to submit the information to his or her diocese if it was outside New York, and then that diocese submitted the information to the Archdiocese of New York. So for literally every person going on at Yankee Stadium, they have a name, address, and date of birth. And although it doesn't appear on the ticket, you are asked to show photo ID. And so it would be hard to scalp or exchange these tickets. And obviously they're absolutely discouraging people from trying to do so, both for security and other reasons. In both Washington and New York, and I hope this gets to your question, there are some opportunities to see the Pope go by. In D.C. on is it Wednesday or Thursday? I think it's Wednesday, tomorrow. People can line up along 4th Street and Michigan Avenue Northeast during a brief period when the Pope will drive by in his Pope Mobile from the headquarters of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. And in New York, on Saturday, people will have an opportunity to line up outside St. Patrick's, and the papal motorcade will go by after that Mass for the clergy from 5th Avenue and 50th Street all the way up to 5th Avenue and 72nd Street.
And commuters in both cities will be looking out to see if these papal celebrations, just snarl traffic. We're talking with Sewell Chan of the New York Times. Also with us is Michael McGough, senior editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get a caller on the line. Jim is with us. Jim calling us from Sierra Vista in Arizona.
How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I was with the Provost Marshal's office at Fort Ord, California, which is in Monterey, California, when the previous pontiff came, and we were part of the security arrangements that were involved, and they did it at, they held the reception or the gathering at Laguna Seca, which is a racetrack, and they flew the pontiff into Fort Ord because it was a secure place to fly him into. But we had dozens of security agencies, law enforcement agencies involved. The training for it and the planning was like 2 months in advance. They showed us all kinds of films, gave us briefings on previous attempts against various pontiffs, the types of organizations that had as their objective to kill the pontiff. It was really, really astounding.
Sewell Chan, I assume procedures are at least that strictured this time.
It's very strict. I mean, the New York Police Department has, you know, all but said that they're locking down the areas where the Pope will be. I mean, everything from counter snipers on rooftops who will be monitoring to see if there's any unusual activity going on rooftops of buildings near where the Pope will be, to literally underwater scuba divers in the East River. The Pope will be at the United Nations. And traffic is being closed off everywhere that the Pope will be. It's interesting, the block that the Pope will be staying on while in Manhattan is actually a pretty heavily trafficked block on the Upper East Side, and the police are entirely closing off that block over the 3 days that he's here in New York City. And if you live or work on that block, you literally will be escorted to your home or place of business by the police after showing your ID. So as you can imagine, the people in that block might feel a little bit inconvenienced.
Thanks very much, Jim.
Yeah.
Let's go now to Clancy. Clancy is with us from Kyle in Texas.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I read that Pope Benedict is going to be allowing the Latin Mass. And my concern is, first off, how many priests nowadays could even say a Mass in Latin? I don't think they teach them in Latin anymore. And, you know, is this just kind of a pat on the head? And because the older priests are the only ones who will be able to do that, it's going to die off by attrition.
Michael McGough, do you know if any of the Masses here are going to be in Latin?
As far as I know...
Excuse me, just a moment. We'll get your microphone up.
Oh, okay.
Just a moment. All right, we're ready now. Go ahead, please.
As far as I know, there may be some Latin hymns, but the main services will be in English. The Vatican has been sort of put on the defensive by this revival of the Latin Mass, and the Pope has made made it very clear that this is not something that's going to be the rule. This is a gesture not only to older people who have nostalgic feelings about the old Latin Mass, but to some young Catholics who are radical traditionalists themselves. But the caller is absolutely right that the so-called Tridentine Mass from the Council of Trent in the 16th century is something that most priests have never performed. And both the language and sort of the choreography are things that are going to have to be sort of taught as an elective in seminaries if this is really going to be done on any scale.
Thanks for the call, Clancy.
Thank you.
And finally, Sewell Chan, who's paying for all of this?
The archdioceses of Washington and New York are bearing most of the cost. The Washington Archdiocese says it will cost at least $3 million, and the Pope is only spending 2 days in Washington. Well, he's coming in this afternoon, Tuesday afternoon, but we'll be in town Wednesday and Thursday. The Archdiocese of New York has declined to release a precise estimate, but the last visit cost about $1.2 million for each day. That Pope John Paul II was in town back in 95. And if you imagine with inflation, but also more importantly with the more tight security, the costs are expected to be, could easily be between $1 and $2 million at least today.
Sewell Chan, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sewell Chan, Metropolitan Reporter for the New York Times, editor of the City Room blog at nytimes.com. And Michael McGough, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Michael McGough is a senior editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times. He wrote the LA Times op-ed, Papal Dress Code, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. Tomorrow, we'll be back at the museum with the political junkie in tow. Join us then. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.